Among the miscellaneous papers I've written are several labeled methodological, and while they deal with psychology as a subject matter, they are mainly contributions to the philosophy of science. In 1947, Kenneth McCorkadale and I were having a late-night conversation while we consumed a fifth of rye whiskey about Hull's famous intervening variable diagram and whether those so-called intervening variables were truly such in Tolman's original usage. We decided there was a confusion between intervening variables and what we unfortunately labeled hypothetical constructs. They were not constructions in the sense of Bertrand Russell, but we didn't realize that at the time. And we arrived at a threefold distinction between the two classes of concepts, which seemed persuasive and illuminating. We expected that on awakening in the morning, the glow would have gone. As it turned out, we both woke up with a mild hangover, but with a persisting conviction that we had arrived at a clarification worth calling to the attention of the profession. Much of the debate between the Hullians and their opponents involved methodological questions about what kind of concepts were acceptable in science and what kinds were not. We published a paper in 1948 that became widely cited and disputed on a distinction between hypothetical constructs and intervening variables. In 1955, Lee Cronbach and I, as a result of deliberations of the APA Committee on Test Standards, applied this distinction to the problem of psychometric validity in a paper that is considered a minor classic, Construct Validity in Psychological Tests. In the early 1960s, the psychology department heard a series of visitors in one of the soft areas who reported on ongoing research programs which were excessively ad hoc. Each new ad hoc hypothesis concocted to preserve a theory from falsification generated another series of experiments, some of which panned out, others not, leading to more ad hocery and so on. These research enterprises did not appear to be converging on anything solid, and the ad hoc adjustments were multiplying as fast as the facts, so that the situation is what philosophers and historians of science would, if they use Lakatos's terminology, call a degenerating research program, although sufficient to publish papers and achieve academic promotion. It seemed to me that there was something radically wrong with the whole strategy, but the thing I focused on was a point about statistical significance tests arising from the fact that in the life sciences, the null hypothesis is always false. I wrote a paper in the Philosophy of Science in 1967, pointing out that improvements in precision and sampling stability in the hard sciences subjects a theory to graver danger of refutation. If the theory is strong enough to make point or range predictions, the more sensitive the design or precise the measurements, the greater the chances of detecting a discrepancy between the facts and the theory's predictions. In the soft areas of psychology, where the theory is too weak to generate predictions stronger than directional trends, as the sample size and the reliability of measurements increase, the statistical power function rises, and hence the probability of refuting the null hypothesis, which is always false, approaches unity regardless of the theory's verisimilitude. I subsequently developed this line of reasoning further in a paper in 1978, which reached a wider audience among psychologists, and even in this day of easy photocopying, I received 1,000 reprint requests before I quit counting. As of this writing, I have in press a long paper on the problem which will appear in the Cronbach Festschrift, Miel 1990. I have been gently needled by friendly colleagues for writing more think pieces than empirical studies, especially in recent years. I enjoy it more and I'm better at it, as shown by the long-term citation rates of my work in the Science Citation Index. Indeed, I dare say few highly visible psychologists have publication lists so preponderantly theoretical and methodological as mine. The profession does not usually view much armchairing favorably. Colleagues even josh me about my being a Donald G. Patterson undergraduate advisee and then a Stark R. Hathaway PhD, both of them disliking, almost despising, mere theory, and yet writing so many more think pieces than empirical studies. Ben Willerman once asked me, "Paul, you are so fascinated by Freud's theory of dream work and tell us persuasive stories from your psychoanalytic practice. Why haven't you done any experiments to test it?" To which I replied, shockingly but honestly, "Ben, it's because I don't know how." In my own defense, I should point out that the publication track record is misleading in this respect for reasons largely out of my control. During the years 1948 to 1965, I was engaged in three major research projects which occupied thousands of hours but have led to scanty publication. One was on political behavior with political scientist Herbert McCloskey, psychologist Kenneth E. Clark, and sociologist Arnold Rose. We built some good instruments and collected a large body of data which have been thoroughly analyzed and are quite fascinating. But the team members dispersed or died, and our leader McCloskey, now at Berkeley, became otherwise involved, so the projected book was never written. I was also working with McCorkadale on a large-scale study of drive and reinforcement parameters in the Skinner box, and after running a couple of thousand rats, we discovered a systematic box effect that confounded things so badly that the intended parametric interactions were uninterpretable. The Ford project on personality descriptors led to a wide coverage and finely honed instrument, and we published a factor analysis of the finding. As noted earlier, through incredible inadvertence, the original raw data were apparently lost. Data that were qualitatively and quantitatively unparalleled, including 248 therapist ratings after 10 or more hours of contact on 791 patients, using a phenotypic and psychodynamic item pool of the highest excellence. These three bad outcomes make one wonder whether the cosmos intended me to stick to my armchair. But I cannot deny that my personality also plays a role in this think piece preponderance. My cyclothymic temperament leads me to become bored with most subject matters after a while. There's also an element of passivity in me that perceptive clinicians come to discern, but that is missed by persons who are struck by my verbal fluency and high social potency, especially in the domain of intellect. Perhaps this is why I enjoyed psychoanalytic therapy more than RET, although the latter is more cost-effective. At heart, I'm more of a knowledge absorber, knowledge integrator, and knowledge transmitter than knowledge producer. I read more widely than most psychologists and enjoy non-psychology reading far more than the strictly professional stuff. For example, during my dozen years as a Lutheran, I read over 300 treatises on theology. When I was on the law school faculty, I read more books and articles on jurisprudence and the appellate decision process than any of my law colleagues had done. Example, none of them had suffered through Roscoe Pound's six-volume jurisprudence, but I did. I have enough scholarly expertise in philosophy of science to teach a graduate course in it. And my philosopher colleague Herbert Feigl once said that any time I wanted to switch fields, he could write me a strong letter of recommendation as a philosophy professor. Now, all this Renaissance man syndrome may be good or ill. The bright students rather like it for a change, but one cannot do it without sacrificing time from empirical research. I have chosen to do so, despite experiencing twinges of scientific guilt about it. I was pleased to be officially appointed adjunct professor of philosophy because that put an institutional seal of approval on my armchair doings. Certainly, it is not a safe mode for a young psychologist to emulate, and I'm careful to point that out to those who identify too strongly with me. These psychodynamic and external happenstance factors are not the whole story, as they are strongly conflated with two rational considerations that I like to think play an important role in my preference for writing think pieces. The first rational consideration is that a scientist should do what he is good at, and I'm better at conceptualizing than at experimenting. My synthetic creative talents are only somewhat superior to most psychologists, cramped by the Dust Bowl empiricist flavor of my Minnesota training, but my analytic powers are, I believe, exceptionally strong, and well-cultivated through long association with top-caliber philosophers of science. Knowledge is advanced in several ways, and it has been my experience that there are many more psychologists who are capable of performing a clever and replicable experiment than there are high-level ideators who can create a novel concept or deeply analyze a familiar one, especially one in controversy. Living off the taxpayer, I feel it appropriate to do what I'm best at, especially since one, it's rare, and two, I find it more fun. The second rational consideration is more important, less narcissistic, but somewhat controversial. For younger readers of these autobiographies, it could be morale-lowering and bad career advice, but we were asked to be as frank and revelatory as seemed fitting. By age 35 or so, I had come reluctantly to the sad conclusion that most empirical research in psychopathology on theoretical matters is nearly worthless, that it does not prove much of anything interesting one way or another, as the Dartmouth Conference of 1950 had, alas, convinced me of the weakness of the grand learning theory systems, a view that is now commonplace. This was not a snobbish dismissal of what others were doing. My research files were full of studies, both on rats and on patients, which were clearly publishable but were never written up. Schizophrenia provides a good example. In my APA presidential address in 1962, I propounded a neurological genetic theory of schizophrenia that was pretty heretical, especially among clinical psychologists. During the ensuing decade, I took some friendly criticism from colleagues about not having published empirical research on this theory. They assumed I was content to have concocted an interesting theory. They were 60% correct about that, and not even trying to research it. But I was. In the decade surrounding that 1962 lecture, I had a half-time RA and was attempting to study the schizotypal personality in several ways. We conducted numerous statistical analyses of large samples of VA hospital patient histories, built a Q-sort for the Hock-Pollitton syndrome, analyzed MMPI and checklist data on my private practice cases, studied psychosomatic and other non-psychotic symptoms and traits in schizophrenic veterans, collected self-descriptive good and bad adjectives on schizophrenic and borderline cases, studied MMPI test misses, identified a strong cognitive slippage factor in the Ford Project item pool, tried to replicate the old Worcester findings as to vestibular nystagmus, entered Roget's thesaurus to locate possible schiz-related low-frequency adjectives, studied MMPI shifts on remission from a schizophrenic episode, constructed a non-psychotic schizotype-specific MMPI key, etc. A lot of thought, time, and work went into these projects, and most were publishable, but we never published them. Why not? Because while they were mildly interesting and largely consistent with my views, they did not strongly corroborate or refute my theory or anyone else's. Meanwhile, as this discouraging truth was becoming clear to me, Popper's Logic of Scientific Discovery had appeared in English in 1959, and his emphases on strong tests, non-inductivism, falsification, etc., were leading topics of discussion in the Minnesota Center for Philosophy of Science. I finally concluded that the whole social science tradition of testing weak theories by the null hypothesis refutation was a methodological mistake, and I found that Popper, Lakatos, and some logical statisticians agreed with me. I realized sadly that if a clinical student needed to learn about schizophrenia in a hurry, I would have him read and reread Bleuler's 1911 classic, then spend 100 hours talking with recent and chronic schizophrenics, then read the research on schizophrenia genetics, and finally the research on schizophrenic soft neurology. But I would not have him waste his precious time reading the hundreds, no thousands, of research studies conducted by psychologists, whether psychometric or experimental. The work is usually inconclusive or trivial, sometimes both. This vast and dismal literature rarely tells us anything we didn't know. When it refutes clinical experience, who believes it? And has not, in my opinion, told us anything really important about the disease, nor helped appreciably to settle any of the controversies concerning it. Seeing this, I resolved not to make any more empirical efforts until I had, 1, developed my theory further, 2, found a few schizotaxia indicators in the literature that show replicably large separations, and 3, found or invented taxometric methods capable of testing numerical point predictions from a strong genetic model. As of this writing, these 3 conditions have finally been met, and I am co-designer of a research project that we believe will definitely corroborate or refute my conjecture that schizophrenia is a low-probability decompensation of a soft neurological integrative disorder, schizotaxia, which is inherited as an autosomal dominant of 100% penetrance. We believe we can now answer the questions, but it has not been possible to do it until the last decade or so. My methodological skepticism about conventional significance testing has meanwhile engendered some good think pieces about that dangerous topic, and the recent literature indicates that they have begun to have an impact. My current thinking and writing are oriented to formulating a positive methodological program, I call it neo-Lakatosian, to replace the conventional null hypothesis refutation strategy. If I can make even a small advance in this direction, that plus my earlier destructive criticism of the received doctrine will be worth a dozen or two average quality empirical studies that I might have done instead. And that might only have added to what Lakatosh called the intellectual pollution of the social sciences. If I have a McDougall master sentiment, it is that of rationality, emphasizing critical open-mindedness. I have been rather little moved by desires for power, money, or helping collective mankind. My professional status motive, the academician's end recognition, is fairly strong, but I think weaker than in most high achievers I know. Witness my strong, long-standing non-attendance at APA conventions, the declining of almost all speaking invitations or book chapter opportunities, and general non-politicking. Given these attitudes and habits, it is odd that I was elected APA president, and I wouldn't stand a chance today. Publishing in both hard and soft areas, or pure and applied, was important during the post-war period. Witness the names Hilgard, Sears, Maurer, Kronbach, Osgood, Miller, Hebb, Lindsay. While critical of many societal arrangements and deeply cynical about politicians, I am not a world improver. Exception, I was a passionate, and for me, active opponent to the Vietnam War. My undergraduate socialism stemmed primarily from the mistaken opinion that a socialist economy would be more efficient rather than from compassion for the poor, hatred of the rich, or the usual academic hostility to businessmen. Voltaire said that in contemplating human affairs, those endowed with an access of feeling are moved to weep, those with an access of intellect to laugh. I'm clearly of the second sort. The overarching value of being open-minded, shutting no cognitive doors, entertaining even strange possibilities, fusion of end cognizance and end play, I see as stemming from a combination of parental precept plus reward plus modeling. One should be fair. Mr. Smith's science class, early readings of authors like Bertrand Russell and science journalist Albert Edward Wiggum, and my teenage logician's peer group, all converging upon a genetic makeup that includes high G, low N dominance, low N affiliation, and a certain kind of passivity, contemplation over action. While this fair-minded obsession, an Alportian radix, has helped me to make scholarly contributions, it has its bad side. Example, I spend time and money, when I hadn't much of either early in my career, learning Rorschach with Samuel Beck and Bruno Knopfler and then doing a lot of it for a while because I wanted to be sure the Minnesota skepticism about projectives wasn't biasing me. I finally realized that the useful yield of incremental validity did not warrant regular use of these instruments, at least as administered by me. I could better have learned that early from the research literature, plus the anecdotal fact that the masters, Beck and Knopfler, were clinically perceptive men, were in reality not all that impressive when interpreting blind. The plain fact is that I wasted a lot of time making sure that I was not being intellectually unfair about projectives. This unity thema of critical open-mindedness, plus more extensive reading in intellectual history than most psychologists indulge in, has sometimes made me receptive to possibilities that are strictly taboo among scientifically trained intelligentsia. Taboo is not too strong a word here, my experience shows. The ideology of scientism as a metaphysic and epistemology and a ground shared faith prescribes certain substantive concepts as well as extra scientific ways of knowing. Colleagues find me paradoxical, some would say inconsistent here, because while I don't understand or trust unscientific ways of knowing, I do entertain substantive notions that are anathema to almost all American psychologists. Example, I'm inclined to think there is something to telepathy, and if forced to bet a large sum one way or another, I would wager affirmatively. My friends invoke the rational conservatism of science, which, in general, I accept as a sensible policy, and tell me this is being too open-minded for my own good. Example, despite its Teutonic metaphysics, Wagnerian bombast, dogmatism, and numerous factual errors, Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West is, I believe, a work of genius containing profound truths about culture and history, and disturbingly diagnostic of our present society. Most scientific historians view Spengler as nothing more than a mystical and fascist crank, so I was pleasantly surprised when a recent issue of Daedalus counted the decline among the 10 most important historical works of our first half century. The most shocking heresy to which critical open-mindedness has led me is about the received doctrine of organic evolution. Students and colleagues react to my rare overt expressions of this view with a mixture of disbelief and amused tolerance, the flavor being, well, Mila is a very bright and reflective man, so we will just have to put up with some funny ideas from him now and then. Some attribute my grave doubts about neo-Darwinianism to a Lutheran upbringing. Quite wrong, as my minimal childhood religious exposure was to a tepid liberal Methodism, my parents and the clergymen I met being comfortable evolutionists. But I find it quite useless to explain to people that my objections to evolutionary theory are philosophical and scientific, not religious. I have had no denominational connection for a quarter century, and presently have no theological opinions. I believe Kant's third great question is unanswerable, but if pressed to speculate about the untestable, I would opt for a kind of non-ethical polytheism, a doctrine hardly suitable for spiritual support or edification. An autobiography in this series is no place for polemics about a non-psychological theory, but since my aberrant views about evolution have been a matter of some curiosity, speculation, and gossip, it is perhaps permissible to list here, without argument, my scientific objections, which are 1. The improbable chance origin of the genetic code. 2. The mutual dependence of DNA and complex cellular organelles, chicken or egg problem. 3. The joint teleology of structures like the vertebrate eye or the neural wiring for the bee's communicative dance. 4. The central improving role of random mutations when the thousands of known examples are uniformly disadvantageous or at best neutral. And 5. The absence of transitional forms in the fossil record. There has been increasing concern about these terrible conceptual and empirical difficulties among scientists in recent years, but no real doubts as to the theory itself. nor will there be any, because evolution is unique among scientific theories in having no imaginable scientific alternatives. Hence, it will be held by educated denizens of our culture, regardless of its theoretical implausibility or empirical counter-evidence. For my part, I don't believe macroevolution by accumulated random mutations ever took place, and I regret that I won't be around 1,000 years hence to see whether the verdict of history vindicates me. Whether my deviant views on this question, held for some 40 years now, have significantly lowered my credibility as to other scholarly matters, I do not know. Writing this autobiography has turned out to be more fun than I anticipated, providing an opportunity to collect my thoughts about the psychologist's enterprise and my modest role in it, and fond remembrances of persons and tasks. The pleasure is tempered by realizing the ephemerality of much of what goes on in our field, and some ambivalent regrets about how I have conducted my professional life. Although I do not see myself as a highly ambitious person, and I believe that I have rarely done any work mainly with visions of social acclaim, like everybody, I enjoy narcissistic rewards. I think the profession has delivered such ego pellets to me somewhat more than I deserve, in terms of lasting major contributions, but this is the kind of thing that the subject of an autobiography is probably not the best person to assess. I sometimes think that the professional recognition came to me too early for my own good, if that makes any sense. My work on the MMPI, latent learning, and methodological questions was becoming fairly well-cited by the time I was in my late 20s. I became chairman of one of the top psychology departments in the world at the age of 31. I was the president of the Midwestern Psychological Association at 34, recipient of APA's Distinguished Scientific Contributor Award at 38, and APA president at 42. Since 1968, I have enjoyed the prestigious academic title of Regents Professor at Minnesota. I've been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and received the Bruno Knopfler Distinguished Contributor Award in Personality Assessment. In 1987, I was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. I have a respectable tally in the Science Citation Index. Some articles 40 years old are still being cited, and a few in the Humanities Citation Index. So, as regards professional success, I have had my share of it, and earlier in life than most. My book on prediction is considered a minor classic, although I wish it had a greater impact than it has on clinical practice, from the standpoint both of helping patients and of saving taxpayer dollars. Colleagues perceive me as having contributed to a more quantitative, objective approach to clinical work, but I'm unable to detect much impact in most clinical settings. An exception would be the actuarial, now increasingly computerized interpretation of MMPI profiles, but even there, the careful validation and empirical comparison of programs has lagged uncomfortably behind their proliferation. I have a theory of schizophrenia, currently being revised, that has received favorable attention, although my diagnostic checklist for schizotypy has not attained wide use. An influence harder to trace, but perhaps more important in the long run than anything I have published, are the PhD candidates I have turned out over the years, an average of one per year for the 42 years I have been on Minnesota's graduate faculty. I am proud to have served as advisor to such contributors as Alec Buchwald, Dante Cicchetti, Richard Darlington, Robert Golden, Harrison Goh, my first PhD, Will Grove, Donald R. Peterson, Leonard Rohrer, William Seaman, and George Welsh. As a teacher, I influenced many students who were not my own doctoral candidates, such as Grant Dahlstrom, Harold Gilberstadt, Ben Kleinmunz, David Licken, Philip Marx, William Schofield, and Norman Sundberg. The distinguished behavior geneticist, Thomas J. Bouchard, Jr., currently chair our department, is an academic grandson of mine via Harrison Goh at Berkeley. One gratification in being a college professor is to realize that at least hundreds, sometimes thousands of persons one has never met have been shaped, helped, and inspired by the lectures, articles, and textbooks of one's students. I have the same feeling when I reflect that there are clinical facilities scattered here and there over the world in which the care of mental patients has become more efficient because the practitioners have been influenced by my writings, however slightly, or by academic teachers and clinical supervisors who are in the academic line of descent from Patterson through Hathaway through Meal students. I have led a secure and leisurely life with a minimum of the financial anxieties and the daily irksome episodes that are part of the human condition outside the academy. I formed a definitive vocational goal to be a college professor at an early age, and I have never regretted that decision. But I have sometimes regretted the field I went into because of its low yield of solid scientific intellectual satisfactions. Those branches of psychology that tend to show the most respectable properties of cumulative and quantitative science are not the ones that interest me or got me into the profession. While I have never had any illusions about being a genius or near genius, I am aware that I'm a pretty bright man, and from time to time I find myself thinking, if I had gone into some other field, like genetics, I would have not merely had a respectable, productive academic career and enjoyed myself at it, but I might have been one of those rare non-genius hybrids who make a major scientific breakthrough. Of course, one knows the statistical odds are against that, even for people in the IQ bracket 175 to 190. And there is almost the element of sheer luck, unless one is professed of unusual focused persistence, which I am not. The weak, but not zero social work side of my nature required at least some degree of activity in direct, face-to-face helping, such as experienced by psychotherapists, physicians, social works, clergymen, and lawyers. Apart from the egocentric question of whether I could have achieved something bigger had I not become a clinical psychologist, there is another factor that leads me to say that despite a pleasant life, interesting companions, and more than the usual share of acclaim by one's fellows, I'm at age 68 a somewhat disappointed man. I find this difficult to explain to younger colleagues and graduate students, and I think the reason is that the cognitive orientation of young people is more realistic, perhaps I should say saner, than was true when I was a student and younger faculty member. The decade between the mid-1930s and the end of World War II was characterized by high optimism about the expected progress of clinical psychology, including optimism about integration of three great traditions from the experimental laboratory, psychometrics, and psychodynamics. When I talk to students about this integrative optimism prevailing among faculty and students, say in 1941, when I entered graduate school, I get the impression that our attitude 45 years ago strikes them as terribly naive on the part of reasonably bright people. In a way, it was. But think of the great books that appeared in the decade 1935 to 1945. We had Dollard's Criteria for the Life History, Thurstone's The Vectors of Mind, Miller and Dollard's Social Learning and Imitation, Alport's Personality, A Psychological Interpretation, Murray's Explorations in Personality, Dollard, Dube, Miller, Maurer, and Sears' Frustration and Aggression, and Hull's Principles of Behavior. I have omitted the most important single book of that period, namely Skinner's Behavior of Organisms, because only a few of us at Minnesota appreciated its earth-shaking significance. These great books of that decade were produced by first-class intellects with quite different biases and interests and little overlap in research technique, but it was possible for a person who was neither stupid nor hysteroid to see in them the signs of rapid advance and intellectually satisfying integration. Thurstone was telling us how to identify the individual differences factors of the mind. Hull was mathematizing the laws of learning. The Yale group was translating Freudian concepts into learning theory and doing ingenious experiments to show reaction formation and displacement in the rat. While I don't suppose any of us had the crazy idea that psychology was practically on the threshold of becoming like chemistry or physics, these exciting developments did make it reasonable to think that it wouldn't be very many years before a large integrative job between the clinical, the laboratory, and the mental testing room would be accomplished. It didn't turn out to be that way within the grand theories of the three great traditions, let alone the integration across them. We have settled for more modest theoretical aspirations, and even with that resetting of sights, the record of psychology as a cumulative quantitative science, especially in the soft areas, cannot be considered impressive by anyone familiar with the state and history of chemistry, physiology, or genetics. I do not want to blow up this change in academic subculture into some sort of personal tragedy for me and my contemporaries, which it certainly was not, although I have known a few psychologists who suffered a major identity crisis, severe enough to include psychiatric symptoms, when they lost the faith they were reared in by their mentor, whether Skinner, Hull, Rogers, or a second-generation disciple of Freud. Looking back, I think that one of my generation's mistakes was to take one kind of scientific theory, what may be called the functional dynamic, as the model for all science, forgetting that there are other kinds of theories in the sciences, which may be labeled as structural compositional, theories concerning what something is made of and how its parts are arranged, and developmental historical theories that narrate how some system or entity formed and grew. Secondly, after taking the more exact physical sciences as our sole theoretical paradigm, we further thought in terms of grand theories. Theories which, as my friend Paul Feyerabend says, are cosmological, in the sense that they say something about everything there is and everything that happens. Whereas there are many interesting, complex, and intellectually respectable mini-theories in the other sciences. Example, the theory of capillary attraction that one learns in a high school physics course. A person with mixed cognitive and helping needs prefers to have an intimate connection between theoretical understanding and the helping process, which I have managed only in the relatively short period in which I was treating patients classically, and even then with the nagging background thought that what I found interesting and scientifically defensible didn't necessarily relate closely with how much I helped the person. I am more likely today to rely on leverage from the relationship and a mixture of common sense, intuition, and bits and pieces of psychodynamics than I am to proceed with some grand strategy, as when we say, whatever happens, your task is to interpret, or whatever happens, your task is to reflect acceptingly the client's current phenomenology, or whatever happens, your job is to reinforce healthy responses and extinguish unhealthy ones. I'm not criticizing practitioners who find it possible to live by these monolithic principles. They may be more effective than I am by doing so, even if they are not theoretically correct. Except for certain pervasive attitudes of skepticism and flexibility that I attribute to my basic science training in psychology, much of what I studied to pass my PhD prelims is not closely related to what transpires in an interview. I have learned to live with that fact, but the point is that when I was a graduate student, I assumed that by the time I reached my present age, we would have figured it out. I'm resigned to this intellectually unsatisfactory state of affairs, and today it rarely makes me uncomfortable in my work, but I'm not pleased with it. These cognitive deprivations aside, I can say that I have had a pleasant and sometimes exciting life as a psychologist. I doubt that I could, in fact, have done a better job or made more important contributions in some other field, and there are fields of science for which my talents and temperament make me totally unsuited. Example, experimental physics. My advice to young persons, other than pick your grandparents wisely, is to have intellectual fun. Because I'm convinced that being turned on by the life of the mind is the most important factor, other than brains and energy, in making even such modest contributions to a field of knowledge as I have.